Today, making super, super again. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working with this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined again by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve.
G'day, Martin.
How are you going?
I'm terrific, thank you. How are you?
Pretty good. Hanging in there with everything that's going on at the moment. It's pretty busy and pretty chaotic, but nevertheless, I wanted to have a conversation today about superannuation. You know, at one level, the most boring, you know, the topic nobody wants to think about, and yet probably one of the most significant and important financial commitments that people have.
And 14 point something million Australians have a super account. So it matters to most adults in Australia, and it's the thing that will matter most to them when they get to retirement age. That's when they'll really start to engage, because unfortunately, people don't engage at the moment. They totally misunderstand it. So, very, very important time.
Yeah, and of course, it's a compulsory savings thing imposed by the government. If you're working age, you're probably saving into a superannuation fund of some sort. So it's not like you can just walk away and forget about it. So you are already in the system, like it or not.
Yeah, well, technically, it's not even your savings. Technically, what it is that your employer makes the contribution and to a fund that is your savings on your behalf. It becomes your savings, but you're not putting it aside. But, yeah, look, if you're in the workforce for 40 years and people nowadays in the workforce through to 67, say, then you can expect to be contributing for most of that time, and it adds up to a very big number. You know, for somebody who's 40 today, they can look at having $500,000 in 2020 dollars when they retire. So it's a huge number at the end of the day, and it makes a difference. Your decisions right now, whether you're 25, 45, 55, your decisions right now make a big difference to how much that is at the end of the time. So think about it today. Don't wait till you're 55 or 60.
Yeah, I can remember when I was in my late 20s, early 30s and was thinking about this, and it seemed such a way, way down the track, you know, to get to 65, and bingo, I'll be 65 this year. And suddenly, oh, wow, that was quick.
Yes, it was. And were you thinking about super when you were 20 or 25?
Well, not really. It wasn't really on my agenda at all at that stage because, you know, there were so many other things I was thinking about, so... Very interesting. Now, there's a few things we should try and cover. The first is this concept of the default fund, because in fact, most Australians are by default in a default fund.
Yeah, look, you go and start your first job and your employer will say to you, now you'll be getting superannuation paid on your behalf. Where do you want it to go? And you'll say, I don't know. And your employer will say, well, look, we use X super fund. Do you want us to put it in that? And you'll say yes. So your employer effectively says, we use a default fund for this company and pay all of the employee's money into that. Now, does that make it the right decision? Not necessarily, because the employer isn't under an obligation to get the best deal for you. The employer does it for all sorts of other reasons. So it's not necessarily the right fund, but you know what? 85, 90% of Australians find themselves in a default fund, for better or for worse. Now, it doesn't mean they're bad. It just means that for better or worse, that's where they are. And it means that they haven't actually made decisions about themselves nor chosen the right fund for themselves.
Right. And it's just worth saying that there are two dimensions of that. Firstly, the entity who's actually managing the fund, right? So there will be, you know, a number of different entities managing superannuation. But the other is the mix of assets in which super is invested. And almost by definition, the default fund has a relatively standard distribution between shares and property and other bits and pieces, right? So, and that means that it may be suboptimal, both in terms of the performance of that fund overall and secondly, the asset distribution.
Yeah, look, you'll normally get sort of 60, 70% equities, half Australian, half overseas. You'll get some infrastructure investment, you know, investing in airports and bridges and stuff. That might be 10, 20% more in some cases, some direct property, some fixed interest investments. So you get that sort of mix, and it means that they're building a mix of assets, a mix of investments that sort of suits the average. Now, averages can be really tricky because averages maybe sort of work for nobody, but they certainly on average, it sort of makes sense, and they call that a balanced fund. Or a growth fund, or a growth balance, or whatever they want to call it. But that's typically what your default fund is.
Yeah, and that will have a certain proportion in cash, but most of it will be in various markets. And of course, one of the interesting observations is as you move through the age bands towards retirement, generally the advice probably would be to shape it more towards cash, in other words, preserve what you've got rather than looking for high growth, whereas when you're young, you can perhaps look for higher growth and essentially look to get the benefits of compounding to work for you.
Yeah, you can, and it's important that you have growth assets in there. So anyone who enters into just a cash kind of balance, a cash fund, is going to find that they're miles behind at the end of the day, because you mentioned compounding very briefly, but compounding is growth on top of growth, growth on top of that, and that and that again. And that's what compounding is. It means that what looks like a small number today becomes quite a large number in 4 years' time. Now, the reason that you need growth assets is that that number's a lot bigger at the end of it. And I forget your question, Martin, or your observation, I know what it was. Yeah. As you age, you might want to be more conservative. Now, that's okay in the past. You know, a generation ago, men retired at 65 and died at 70. Now men are retiring at 67 and dying at 82, 84, but in a few years' time, that's going to be late 80s. So you can't actually ever go fully to cash. The principle is that you want a little more in cash maybe, but you don't want to go totally to cash, whereas a 25-year-old really doesn't want much in cash at all. They would take advantage of the compounding. Mm. Some funds have actually life cycle stage default funds where they do recognise that you go aggressively to begin with and gradually more conservatively as one ages.
Yes, that's right. But not all of them do, and it's worth asking the questions to whether it does shape over time or whether it just is a fixed relationship right the way through the life of the fund, because it does make a difference.
Yeah, it's a tricky choice, though, because, I mean, with that extra 20 to 30 years of life after retiring age, you don't want to go conservative totally and ever, and certainly not too early. So, I'm a believer in saying, well, look, you're not just thinking through to age 65, you're thinking beyond that. Mm-hmm. Now, at age 65, 67, when you retire, and you'll be starting to draw down to live off your superannuation, certainly you want enough in cash so that if the market does tank, you're not drawing on that element of your fund while the market's down. 25-year-olds can live through five down cycles, five big corrections in the market. 67-year-olds probably can't.
That's probably true, unfortunately.
And unless they're living to 100.
Yeah, well, I'll try. We talked about compounding, which is the interest on the interest, and of course that is where the growth comes from. But the reverse of that is the fees, right? Because as fees are taken out each year, that actually comes effectively off your balance. So the higher the fees, the worse the outcome will be on a sort of post-compounded basis.
Absolutely. I mean, it works just the same way. If you pay $1,000 too much in fees every year of the 40 years you're paying super, you're not down $40,000. Compounding is going to take that up over $100,000. So it absolutely knocks around your end balance. It hurts dramatically. And I said $1,000 difference, and I'm not exaggerating, because the lowest price default fund that CanStar looks at on its website is $800-something per year total fees, and the highest is $1,800-something. So near enough $1,000 difference. That's a massive difference, and it hurts so much to your retiring savings.
Mm. Yeah, well, I always say to people, do you know what you're paying on your superannuation? They say, no, no idea. Well, which is worth finding out, right? There should be some information there. And it's not straightforward, because the fees are broken down into various categories, right? And some relate to the management of the fund, and some relate to the transactions in the fund and all sorts of things. So but it's worth getting to understand it.
Martin, you can't always, even from your annual statement, you cannot always tell what your total fees are, because you'll see what your administration or your management or your membership fee is. That's very clear. But on top of that, or those two sometimes, there'll also be a fee. On top of that, there is always a fee for management of your investments, because the super funds outsource part of that. But even in the insource part, it's a separate fee they charge. And the problem with that is that very often the returns on those investments are quoted net of fees, and you never actually get to work out what your fee is just by reading your annual statement. And that should be the thing that tells you everything you need to know about it. So there is a problem there. Now, we, in our ratings, dig a lot deeper and find out what those fees are. But yeah, people don't get it, and they don't know the questions to ask. And I'm not sure they get the answer, to be quite honest, from some super funds.
No, the industry is very mute on this, and the ASIC has been pushing very hard to make disclosure clearer so that people can make better decisions. But frankly, it's still a minefield, and it is very hard to really get to the bottom of why my fees are what they are and how much I'm really paying. So all I guess I can say is it is worth asking the question and digging down, but it's not straightforward.
ASIC has been asking for years, and if they can't get the answer, you and I, Martin, are probably going to struggle to.
That's probably true, and probably that may be true of end user super people as well. Now, one other interesting question here is, you know, you've got this super and then you move job, right? Now, one of the other tricks to bear in mind is it's sometimes the way that you end up with multiple super funds in different locations as you move around from job to job. And that's not necessarily very optimal, is it?
I have a daughter who years ago had five, not with almost nothing in them, and they were all being charged membership and admin fees, and in time they would have been worth virtually nothing. Now, government has come in, stepped in and said, look, you can't charge more than X fee for, you know, some, you know, nominal fee for small accounts, which is a great thing. And if they get small enough and become dormant, then they don't charge at all. But nevertheless, if you have multiple accounts, and you will be paying, doubling up on fees, basically, just doubling up. And plenty of young people in particular, because they've got part-time jobs and they've moved in jobs a number of times, they're the ones mainly who have multiple fees. They can be paying an extra $200 or more for each of those and find that it's wiping their balances out, and that hurts them long term. So do not do that, and it's so easy to consolidate. You choose the one fund you want to go to. You go onto their website, identify yourself. If you're already a member, you don't even have to go to the trouble of identifying yourself. And you sign an authority that they then present to your other funds. They'll even find them for you. And they then take care of it for you. Get the cash in, stick it into one account, and wipe out those duplicated fees. But it's one of the must-not-dos in superannuation. You must not have multiple fees, multiple accounts, unless you're doing it for the insurance, for example. And that can be a valid call.
Yeah, and we'll come on to insurance a second, because that's something else that we should touch on. But the point to make there is that the chances are, if you've moved around, you may have multiple, it's worth trying to track them all down. And in fact, there are some tools online available that help people find lost super as well.
Yeah, there are. The ATO kind of is the engine that drives all of that, and they'll find it for you, but you can go in via various tools. But your super fund will do it for you anyway. So you know, you short-circuit it, make life a lot easier for yourself by just dealing with your own super fund. But then it might be a fresh super fund, of course, too, because, you know, if you're going to go to that trouble, well, look for the best one for you. You don't just go with one of the ones you've got. You know, don't toss a coin or put the numbers in a hat and pull one out. Actually, make the decision that, you'll go for the one that's right, because they're not all super funds are equal, I can tell you.
No, well, we'll come on to that in a second. But before we do, let's just talk about the life insurance aspect. So many funds, in fact, probably most funds, have a life insurance component to it. But that's got a little bit tricky too, isn't it?
That's actually about the trickiest part of super. And I know because we rate these things. So I reckon it's the trickiest bit. Now, the good thing about it is that Australians are underinsured. They insure their cars, they insure their houses. They don't insure their income or their life. We are vastly underinsured, and that's a massive risk for young families, and especially young families with mortgages, but young families, frankly, massive risk. Now, through your super, you'll see a 30-year-old who's right in the mortgage band, right in the young family band, who will get around $150,000, $180,000 of tax, and that's the default superannuation cover. Now, that's better than nothing, but you know what? It's not enough. You've probably got a mortgage of $500,000 or $600,000, and you've got three kids, and you're on one income at the moment with a bit of part-time, and frankly, you're not leaving enough to fix the family if something goes wrong. So one of the risks with insurance through super is that people become complacent. They think I'm covered, and basically they're not covered enough generally. Then on the other side of that argument, you've got the 25-year-old who's running around playing footy at the weekend, no family commitments, might or might not have a mortgage, but an investment property or something. But at the end of the day, if that 25-year-old has an accident and doesn't live, well, gee, there's no financial dependency, so maybe they don't need to spend the money on insurance. And they've got to remember that every dollar they put into insurance is a dollar that's not working for them towards their retirement savings. So that's one of the issues there. The government's acted on this one too, because the government looks at super very closely. So they've acted on that. And they've acted on it and said, look, if you're under 25, you now opt into default insurance, not out of default insurance. So in other words, if they do in the past, if they did nothing, they were paying for the insurance. Now, if they do nothing, they don't have insurance. Now, there are arguments for permanent disability and stuff like that. But frankly, the amount of cover for permanent disability isn't really enough to take care of a 25-year-old for life anyway. So it's fraught, it's tricky, made even trickier because the superannuation policies are different from fund to fund. I mean, if you're working on high-rise buildings or in mining industry or something, your super policy costs a lot more, but you're covered for much, much higher risk. If you're working in a public service office as a clerk or something, then your risks are a lot lower. You don't need as expensive cover. Maybe it's an issue that says, look, don't go and join that super fund because you'll be paying too much for your insurance. So it's tricky to get the right cover, tricky to get the right kind of approach to comparing insurance policies via superannuation.
Absolutely. And I've seen some people with multiple premiums going out from multiple super funds, right? And none of them really were fully aware of how much they were paying out each month for this life cover that really wasn't appropriate for them. So that's again another trap as well.
Oh, it is. Look, and in particular, if you don't have dependents, I mean, you can argue the arguments about superannuation are limitless and endless, but you can argue that maximum cover is great, but it's not, because everything is being paid for somehow or another. There's no free ride with insurance, and it hurts your retirement savings. So it's a trade-off. As most things in life are.
Now, let's talk about returns, because the shocking thing is that, you know, you can have two default funds and yet the returns on those funds are massively different, aren't they?
We look at the default funds, and the minimum return that we have on default funds on our website is 1.54% over a five-year period, and that's net of fees. The maximum is 9.53%. Now, that's over 5 years, so 8% every year difference. And with the compounding we talked about before, oh, my gosh, that's a huge amount. Now, we looked at a much more conservative thing and said if you move from a fund to another one that pays 1% more for your 40-year working life. Now, as a 35-year-old, so with 32 years left to work, so 1% higher return, you'd lift your retirement savings from $740,000 to $919,000. Now, that's a lot of money, $180,000 difference to live off. Makes a lot of difference at your retirement age, at your retirement period, and it's done without hurting your lifestyle. That's the beauty of it. You don't have to give up anything, and you end up a lot better off. Now, that's in future dollars, that particular number, but nevertheless, it's still a big number, and you can't afford, just through complacency, to stay in an underperforming fund. Now, if you multiply that to the difference between 1.5 and 9.5 return, you can see how huge a number that becomes.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, Canstar, for example, will actually demonstrate the different returns across a whole range of funds, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we look at the default funds because that's where 85% of people end up. Nevertheless, that's just in the default funds. When you look at the fees on some of the old legacy products that some of the superannuation companies still have, their returns are even worse than the worst that you talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last thing I think just to touch on briefly is self-managed super, because there are people who actually take themselves out of the statutory system and basically roll their own, as it were. But there are some benefits, but also some risks attached to that, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. Typically, they started, I think, more than any other reason for self-employed people. And self-employed people said, look, we want surety of where we conduct our business from. We want to own the premises we work from. We can't afford to buy them through any other mechanism. We'll buy them through our superannuation. And they can do that. There are a squillion rules around it, but that's one of the things they can do. Now they've opened up to a lot of other people, and there are some good and bad things happening. People can borrow and own property. They can own property and they can borrow in their super fund. Now, that's okay if you have a $2 million super fund and you put $1 million into it as property. Well, that's a decision that you can say, well, okay, that might be right, it might not be, but it's okay. Unfortunately, there have been spruikers out packaging the whole thing up, and you might have a $200,000 super fund and you'll borrow $150,000 and buy some little investment property somewhere, so that you've virtually tied up your whole fund in one property and it's geared. Now, that's a bad decision. That's never a good decision, tying the whole fund up in one asset, and certainly not in an asset that is illiquid. And illiquid just means that you can't realise the value of it without selling the whole thing. So that's one of the worst outcomes. Frankly, though, somebody with $250,000 should not be in self-managed super. You need to employ an accountant and an auditor every year. That will cost you a lot more than just having an account-based superannuation fund. And the cutoff, some people say the cutoff's $300,000. I actually think it's probably $500,000. And even then, I think it's not a great call for most people, because the real issue is you're saying you can manage your money better than professional money managers, and not many people can. And if you think you can beat the market all the time, well, great, but I don't think many people succeed unless you're going to really commit to working hard and make all those decisions, the ongoing management of your money. Well, don't bother, let the professionals do it.
Yeah, and the point is there, a self-managed super fund is effectively a separate legal entity, so it has to be managed, if you like, at arm's length. And it requires auditing and all those other things, and you know, there are fees attached to it. So people need to be very careful. I do hear people all the time saying, oh, that's simple. You know, you can make a lot more money through self-managed super. Not necessarily true. In fact, if you look over the last few years, statistics from ASIC has suggested that, in fact, most self-managed super funds underperform relative to the best performing funds that are out there.
Yeah, they do, and it's an unfortunate thing. People think that they're smarter than their super funds. They think that they'll save $1,500 worth of fees a year. Well, they're paying that away to their accountant and the auditor instead of the super fund, and they're not making and not putting enough time into making and not skilled enough to make proper financial decisions that manage risk and balance a portfolio and all of those other things. So, yeah, rarely do people get it totally right. I get it for self-employed people who want to buy a premises because there are good business reasons for doing that. But even then, they're putting all of their eggs into one basket. Their earnings and the property are engaged in a business enterprise that if it fails, well, you sort of lose a fair bit of both. So rarely is it the right call for people.
Yeah, oh, I tend to agree with that. Now, the last question I had was the combination of providers of superannuation include retail funds, which are mostly owned by the big banks or, you know, big financial institutions, and the industry funds, which are effectively more union-based. Now, what is the difference in returns between those two camps, as it were?
Yeah, traditionally they were very different models, and the big banks and insurers and the like had been running superannuation for a lot longer than the industry super fund, which only came around in 1992 when Paul Keating brought in the compulsory superannuation. And the model they had then was basically through employers. Big employers would have a superannuation arrangement before super was broadly available, and those legacy funds were an absolute gold mine for those insurers and banks that ran them. They could pick up 4% of fees and things, just crazy, crazy fees. And as a result of that, the returns were a lot lower. When the industry funds came along, they cut fees a lot and put much more sensible fees into place, and fees have come down even since then. And it meant that the returns that they were achieving started to look a lot better than the traditional retail funds. And we all know the ads where, you know, you'd stand two people next to each other and say they looked alike in every sense except that one was going to retire on $100,000 more. And it wasn't exaggerating because it was essentially fees were the difference. Mm. Nowadays, they've grown a lot more alike in some ways, in that a lot of the default funds, for example, for retail super funds, the fees are comparable enough with the industry super funds. The big difference still that exists other than the history, the other bit of history is that the industry super funds were tied to a union, so an industry, a union, a workplace. Nowadays, that's less so. They're open to the general population to join whatever they want to join. The other big difference now still, though, is that the industry super funds tend to have more in the way of direct investment. And that's investment in high-rise buildings, even development of high-rise buildings, in particular development of high-rise buildings, and also infrastructure projects, so toll roads and airports and et cetera, et cetera. So essentially their investments are different, and the investments of the industry super funds tend to be a little bit less liquid. They'll still have plenty of shares and fixed interest, but they'll have much more illiquid investment, but then they've cut out the middleman in a lot of ways, so that they can bring more of the profits from those investments to their members, and they're not for profit, of course. So that's the benefit. The other side of it is they're not as liquid, and if there's a run on the fund, then that can hurt, and they get a little bit of press coverage when the superannuation return via COVID came into play. That got some play then because there was a huge demand on some of those industry funds for early release. And of course, people started to worry, well, are they too illiquid? Now, they wrote out that story.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we should just briefly talk about the extract of funds. You know, there's more than what, 20 billion now, I think, taken out of the funds, and people are not quite sure precisely who's taken it out and what they've done with the money, but it does seem to have been something which attracts younger people particularly.
Martin, we saw something quite worrying. We were looking at some of our web statistics the other day, and we saw that traffic was right up on one of those pages that referred to what's the go with this withdrawal of funds, how does it work? And the other one that absolutely matched it was the online share trading site. So we're sort of hoping that most of these people haven't just put it into online share trading and taken advantage of an extraordinary market in recovery from the initial March fall. But that's a little side issue, but it's a worry. The question then, though, is, well, what's going on with that money? The other thing we saw is the ABS set showed an absolute record fall in the amount of debt on credit cards. Now, what appears to be happening there is that people are taking their money out, and either they're saying that sticky bit of credit card debt I'm going to clear and clear forever and never get into trouble again. I hope that's not a bad outcome.
Fingers crossed.
Or they're saying, I've got this ugly credit card debt. I'm going to clear it, but park that there so that if things get worse for me, then I can live off that $10,000, which is, of course, what it was meant for. And why would you not do that when frankly, you're paying away, 14% on credit card debt and only getting 1% on savings? So, well, that's a logical call as well. But then I was on a train the other day listening to a conversation, and the young guy was saying he pulled out $10,000 from his super, which he said was tax. He was getting a tax refund of $10,000, and he was going to buy a go-kart and pay off some afterpay. So there's some really messy stuff going on. Now, if $10,000 from your super and then another 10 you can access now, if that $20,000 saves you financially or saves your house, well, that's a good thing. But $20,000, $10,000 out now for a 40-year-old is $28,000 difference to your retirement savings. And that's in today's dollars. So in future dollars, that's 50-something thousand, I'd say. So $28,000 out, and if you take out 20, well, that's $56,000. Now, that's a big dent. You can actually restore your superannuation balance by putting in $95 per month in a year or two's time and continuing to do that for all the way through your retirement, and that puts you back where you were. Now, obviously, $95 an extra, $95 now, if you're had to do this, well, you don't have that. But in 2 years' time, hopefully, things will be back to normal. People should think about those sort of actions when they do recover financially and just to restore their retirement savings for the longer term. So it's been maybe a lifesaver for some people. I fear that it's been money wasted for other people. But do something about it later on when the world returns to normal.
Well, let's hope it does return to normal relatively soon, although it may take a little while. And I guess, Steve, the last point then is, of all the things we've discussed, what do you think the most critical point for somebody with a super fund would be in terms of what they should be doing?
Yeah, okay. The most critical thing is not to be complacent. Don't accept that you're in the right one because you always have been. Compare super funds. And look, you don't have to go beyond default. Compare super funds, though, because the default funds are pretty good still. Choose the right one for you. Make sure you understand the net performance return. So how well the fund is doing with your money in the investment markets minus the fees paid. Still look for fees to make sure they're not outrageous, because fees have certainty, investment returns don't necessarily. Look at your insurances, make sure it's enough, and make sure that what you're getting in the super fund suits you. And finally, the investment option you choose is important too. But for most people, look, the default's not too bad. So it's three or four things to think about. It's not rocket science. It's not that hard. And there are places you can go. I can't say that actually enable you to do it in one spot.
Yeah, and the point I would like to leave is that it is something that you mustn't just set and forget. You must come back to it from time to time to time, because things vary, performance varies, fees vary. And actually, once you start looking at it, it isn't as complicated as it sounds, particularly when there are good tools around to help.
It's absolutely not. There are good tools to help you choose between super funds, and the super funds have slick processes to get you opened in an account and to pull in money from elsewhere. They're not quite as slick letting go of money, but they're pretty slick pulling it in from elsewhere. So it isn't hard. It's very easy, and the super fund will take care of all that process for you for nothing. You know, the tricky bits for them. It's sort of like a rainy afternoon's work, to be honest.
Yeah, or maybe something if you're locked down a bit longer and you've got something nothing else to do, go check your super fund.
No better time.
Steve, I appreciate your time today. Great advice there, and thanks once again for sharing your thoughts with us.
Pleasure, Martin.